morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's good to see all of you here. I know we're short on numbers today. That's okay. So, pain. Pain. Everyone, I believe, in this human existence experience pain. And while some of us may experience pain constantly, some of us may experience pain intermittently, or we may have multiple pains.
Can you turn that up a little? Is we'll have Jared do it. Sorry.
He'll be back in a minute.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Sorry.
It's okay. That was painful.
I'm sorry.
Well, I had a medical procedure done this past week. It's called a nerve ablation, and so I saw my doctor, and they put me under on the table, and they use an active X-ray machine, and they can actually see where the needles are going, and there's this long needle that they insert into your back, and then they get it up against the nerve that they believe is, you know, contributing to pain, and it could be that the nerve is rubbing up against part of the spine, and or maybe something else anyways, and they burn it. And what that burning does is, yes, it does hurt, but after it heals, it builds a callus. And so what that does is creates kind of like a thick skin like you would have on your feet, you know, like a callus builds up and you don't typically feel anything. And this is my third one, and they typically, you know, it's painful for a week or two, and then it subsides, and then I have, reduced pain. So instead of being at a 5 or a 6 in my lower left back, you know, it'll drop down to about a 2 usually. So when I was there with my doctor, we're talking because it's my third time there, and it's like, you know, it's like there's got to be something more. And he said, pain is a funny thing. He's like, even at a singular cell level, you could take the smallest organism on the planet, put it in a petri dish, and then add a little bit of acid into that petri dish, and that organism will move to the opposite side of the dish to be away from that acid. And so at the very smallest level, there's positive stimulus and negative stimulus, right? Negative stimulus we tend to go away from, and positive stimulus we tend to go towards. And he also highlighted this by giving an example. He had a veteran who came in who lost, basically his nerve was severed to his lower body, so he was paralyzed. And he could feel nothing in his legs. And then one day, you know, he had a visit, you know, with him, and he was complaining of pain in his legs. And he's like, well, that's impossible. Your nerves are all severed from your spinal injury. And what that goes to show is what he's learned is one thing with pain, and this is what he said, pain will find a way. He goes, we can burn your nerves, ablate them. We can sever nerves. We can, you know, do all these things. We can add a stimulator to your back. We can take medicines, and we can do all these things. But it's a funny thing that pain will always find a way back. You know, and so it made me realize that in this human physical existence, we cannot avoid it. We cannot avoid pain. It's part of this human condition that God's given us, the ability to experience good and evil, the ability to experience pleasure and pain. And in our spiritual and Christian walk, that negative pain should also be a reinforcement of things that we shouldn't want to do or we should avoid. And of course, you know, bringing this into the message today, we really must consider the fact that there's going to be a day where you won't feel pain. Pain will be gone. There will be no more suffering. There will be no more sorrow. And it says in Revelations, you know, that he will, that all those things will be taken away. And so when we're spirit beings also, you know, we're not going to feel pain. We're not going to feel the sorrow. And you have to actually go back to the time of the Garden of Eden. Think of back then. Was there pleasure and pain back then? Well, there's no indications that there were. That they were living in unity with God. And that they were at peace. And, you know, they had plenty of food to eat. You know, they had plenty of time on their hands to do stuff. You know, but did they have to necessarily work or exert themselves? We don't know. But we do know that when man sinned, you know, Eve and then Adam, that, you know, that he said that you're going to toil in the soil, you know, and you're going to basically blood, sweat, and tear, you know, to produce the food that you're going to want to eat. And it's not going to be an easy life. And there's going to be a lot of negative stimulus. So you go from the Garden of Eden, where it was a very positive place, to a very negative place, where now we're in a position where we're trying to find those pleasures and avoid those not so pleasurable things or the negative. So in a sense, what I'm saying is we're just like any other organism. If you jump in a swimming pool and then someone pours hydrochloric acid in it, and you're going to jump out of the pool to avoid that pain. Now, God gave us pleasure as well, but he gave us pleasure to enjoy as a good thing. But man has taken that to the extreme where he's trying to cover up the pain. And he covers up the pain by doing drugs, alcohol, risky behaviors and whatnot, and you could fill in the blank. Gambling, overeating, you know, there's plenty of examples in the Bible where people are in pain and they seek those things that create pleasure or give them a relief. Because that's, you know, I just want a break from my back pain. I just want a break. It'd be nice just to have 1 week where I don't even know what it's like to have back pain, you know. So, when you look back at the Garden of Eden, and before the sin happened, there was a condition that happened, or there was a attitude, there was a thought process, you know, that started in the mind. And when Eve was tempted, you know, she chose to defy God. She chose to rely on herself. She judged for herself on, you know, whether this was something she should do or not, and in a sense made herself God. And in a sense she judged God too in that, you know, look, maybe you are holding something back from us. So I'm judging you and I'm thinking you just don't want me to have to, you're just keeping something from me. So what was the first sin of man? Pride, right? What was the first sin of Lucifer? Pride. He was lifted up. Now, imagine you're born spirit and you've never known a physical existence. You've never known pain. You've always and constantly lived feeling good. Every day is like, I feel great. And I have these abilities and I feel great. Look at all this stuff. I've made all these planets and I've done all these things and I've influenced all these people. I feel great. And I'm smart and I'm growing in knowledge and I'm learning to do this and I'm learning to do that. Until one day, the creation thinks it's better than the creator. Now, the inspiration for today's message came from Mr. Arrett, because he gave a sermon on the sins of Sodom. And if you want a title to today's message, the title of today's message is Opposite of Sodom. Now, I'm not talking about a geographical location opposite of Sodom, but it could be, because we are Israel, we are God's chosen. Are we not opposite in location to Sodom geographically and spiritually? Yes. So But I'm taking the spiritual path so that we should be in opposition to whatever Sodom and Gomorrah did. So today's title message is Opposite of Sodom. And the inspiration for that came in the verse in Ezekiel 16:49. So if you'll turn to Ezekiel 16:49, Mr. Eric pointed out the three sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. In Ezekiel 16:49, it says, "Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had 1, pride; 2, fullness of food; 3, abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy, and they were haughty and committed abominations before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw fit." Now I want to pick up where Mr. Eric left off, because, you know, when you look at civilizations like Rome and how it fell and other civilizations, how they fell, there's this cycle in man, right? There's this pattern. And in our own personal lives, whether you look at the example of David or Solomon, you know, you see a cycle of their life. It's like, well, how could he go from being the wisest man on the planet to, you know, worshiping idols? It doesn't make sense. How could this happen? Well, pride is obviously the culprit involved, and it's something that we unfortunately develop ourselves. Now, to kind of build on what Mr. Eric referenced on the three sins, I want to also point out that there's a 4, 5, and 6. So when you read that scripture, you could also say, neither did she, number 4, strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. Number 5 was haughty. And number 6 committed abominations before me. So if you really think about it, you have cause and effect, right? So what's the effect of having pride and fullness of food and idleness, which you could say is the cause, right? And the effect is going to be your haughtiness, committing abominable acts. These are the actions, right? Paul talked about a seed, the seed of sin that starts in the heart and the mind. But when it's full grown, it's those outward actions, right? It's killing someone, it's lying, it's committing adultery, it's breaking the Sabbath. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a 6-part series, because there's no way I could cover, you know, what it is that I need to cover in a sermonette. And just to give you a heads up, I'm going to describe to you the 6-part series. And the first part of the series is pride versus humility. Because Mr. Eric talked about the sins, and I thought it would be great to follow up with, well, what is the opposite of those sins? What can we as Christians do to oppose those behaviors found in Sodom and Gomorrah so that we don't find them in our lives? So 1, pride versus humility. The 2nd will be fullness of food versus satisfied and eating just enough or grateful for the meal. 3 will be idleness versus work. 4, committing abominations versus abstinence from evil pleasures or sexual immoralities. 5, greedy and selfish versus giving and selfless. And 6, haughty versus modesty. So today we're going to cover pride versus humility. Now, there are 2 types of pride in the Bible that we can find an example. The first type of pride is legitimate pride. And the other is sinful pride. And what do I mean by that? Well, follow me here. The Bible is clear that it's okay to encourage and admonish each other and to take pride in good works of God and His creation. We can be proud to be children of God, right? But we cross into sin when it revolves around ourselves. And we go back to the Garden of Eden. It evolved around Eve. Me. Self. Self-preservation. You know. Desire. All those things, it's like, I'm feeling a negative stimulus here because I feel like something's being withheld from me. So, you know, whatever's being withheld must feel good and must be good for me, so therefore I want it. So seeking out that pleasure or that positive experience. So there are many definitions of pride in the Bible. And you know, one I find interesting is the Webster's Dictionary of 1828. And it says, pride, the noun, it's an inordinate self-esteem, an unreasonable conceit of one's own superiority in talents, beauty, wealth, accomplishments, rank, or elevated in office, which manifests itself in lofty airs, distant, reserved, and often in contempt of others. And it sounds like the description of Lucifer, right? He knew better. He wanted to go up and be like the Most High, you know? Lucifer was beautiful, right? He was wealthy, he traded, you know? He was full of trade. He was also full of wrath. He was high up in the ranks, was he not? He was elevated in office, you know? Well, in contempt of God he was, right? So when we look at this Webster's Dictionary description of pride from 1828, you can see an example just in the Bible just through Lucifer's downfall. You know, he continues on in Webster's Dictionary 1828, which is obviously Webster. Pride goes before destruction, you know, Proverbs 16:8. Pride that dines on vanity, you know. Insolence, which is rude treatment of others, or insolent exaltation. You know, you can think of those very high up, you know, leaders who like just beat down their peasants or beat down their servants or just do with them whatever they want. Generous elation of the heart, a noble self-esteem springing from a consciousness of worth, the honest pride of conscious virtue. So, elevated loftiness, decoration, ornament, you know, there's some more, splendid show, that which men are proud, which is excited through boasting, excitement of sexual appetite in a female beast, which I thought was very weird, as one a definition. But pride is also talks about a pride of lions. You know, it's the pride. Or number nine, a proud person. Now I wanted to go and look at another. You know, that's from the 1800s, and you know, over time definitions change. You know. And so the definition we may be searching for today may not be the definition that was intended at the time, maybe when even part of the Bible was written. So it's always good to cross-reference, you know, that actual meaning of the word at that time as stated. Not how man redefines words, because man's always changing the narrative. They're always changing the definitions to fit the times. So I looked at, so to get a good idea of a definition, it's good to look at multiple sources from multiple periods. So I went to the dictionary.cambridge.org US, which is the Cambridge Dictionary, and it says pride. So there's a list of things about feelings. So pride is the feeling of satisfaction, right? You know, so when God, you know, saw his creation, you know, he was satisfied. There's a pride of his creation, you know. And it's not like, oh, look what I did. It was just a sense of like, that's beautiful. It's no different than, you know, you have a community pool, right? And this community pool is like, it has water slides and it looks like an oasis. And it's like, You know, I live in a small town with a post office, and there's only 500 of us, but we have got the coolest pool. So there's a sense of pride for the pool because it's just beautiful. It was created. It has nothing to do about oneself. It has to do about, you know, something that was made that's just the pride of the community. Now, a part of that feeling of satisfaction, a feeling of pleasure and satisfaction that you get because you or people connected with you have done something good, right? So being in church, you know, maybe going over to someone's house and helping them. I know we went over and helped Mrs. Good. We went over and helped the Denos. And, you know, there's a sense of connectedness and pride as a church group that we can come together and do good in God's name to help other people. So not all pride is bad. Another one is a feeling of worth, your pride, you know? So your feeling of your own worth and respect for yourself. And, you know, we're supposed to, you know, our bodies are a temple of God, and we need to respect that body. We need to respect our body in the sense that we should abstain from just illicit sex with whoever, whenever, because if we do, we could get a disease. And so in a sense, you know, you should respect the body that God gave you. Have pride in the fact that He built you the way He built you, and that you should want to preserve that, you know, and not harm it, you know, no different than getting a sports car and then taking off-roading, you know, a Lamborghini off-roading, you know, could be disastrous. But to take pride in that vehicle and to take care of it as a gift given to us. So it's okay to have self-pride in a biblical sense, you know. But then there's the other pride too, where, you know, you may refuse an offer for a takeover of your business because of your pride. It's like, you know, you should probably sell your business. Things aren't going good. There's another company that wants to buy at your competitor. But because of your pride, because, you know, you don't, you know, that feeling of being elevated above someone else, I'm not going to let them take my company over. You know, that would be an example of the opposite. There are many examples in here. So the next one is proud, is respect for yourself, which I talked about. So having that respect for that yourself, and that you respect your body, that God made you in His image and in His likeness. You know, you shouldn't cast pearls before swine. Now, it's also a feeling of importance, right? It's a belief that you are better or more important than other people, you know? And so we've heard that pride was his downfall, you know, because he thought he was better. He thought he had, he knew everything and everything was, and then all of a sudden, you know, because he wouldn't listen to anyone because only he had the best ideas and everyone else was inferior to him and only he knew the way and didn't want to listen to counsel or wisdom, went to ruin. So that's where they say, you know, pride was his downfall. You know, if you look at the military leaders, Napoleon and Hitler, it was their pride. They drove into Russia. Even in winter, I mean, you know you can't beat Russia in winter. It's game over. So if you haven't taken them over before winter, you might as well just leave. But it's that false illusion of grandeur that I can't be defeated. You know, my army's invincible. Weather, it doesn't matter with weather. We're the toughest. You know, it's that self-elevated pride. So I've covered a few definitions of pride to kind of, because I know in times past we say, you know, we say pride. And we talk a little bit about it, but we never really research it into detail to kind of stimulate the mind and the thought processes behind pride, because oh, all pride's bad. Well, hold on here. You know, there are examples in the Bible where there's the right kind of pride. And so we're going to look at the ways to be able to surgically separate good pride versus bad pride. So our prideful nature manifests itself in three ways and can be seen as a formula. So if you like formulas and you like doing math and calculating, you know, we have a formula for you. We can use this formula in seeing examples in the Bible and in our own personal lives, which is especially important given the Passover is coming up soon. So just to keep this kind of on the light side, so here's the formula. It's S1 plus S2 plus S3 equals P. So S1 is self-reliance, S2 is self-centeredness, and S3 is self-condemnation, and that equals P, which is pride. I'll give that to you again. S1 is self-reliance, S2 is self-centeredness, S3 is self-condemnation. You add up all of those, that's a lot of pride. And why is that important? Because when we go back and we plug that formula into looking at Eve, you know, she took onto herself self-reliance rather than relying on God. She was very self-centered. If you think about it, what she did impacted generations to come after her. You know, if you look at folks who do things that like impact other people's lives, whether it's families or nations or colleagues, or they're not thinking about anyone but themselves. And Eve was thinking about herself, what she wasn't getting, like as if life wasn't good enough for her. And then self-condemnation, or we could say that's judging. She judged God. You know, God's holding something back from me, you know? And I'm gonna be the judge now. I'm gonna decide whether I'm gonna eat this fruit or not. Now, Adam fell right in the same in line too. You know, his self-reliance was more on his wife. You know, he didn't rely on God. He was very self-centered because, you know, he wasn't thinking about the next generations or all of his training he may have had. You know? And then, you know, as far as judgment, he too, you know, put himself in the place of God to follow in Eve's footsteps. Now, you can also plug this formula in for Satan. You know, he had self-reliance in that he felt like everything he did was from himself. Well, if God didn't make you, you wouldn't do anything. And the example of Nebuchadnezzar stands out in my mind, where God took away that spirit of man that he puts in us to be able to have that reasoning and made him essentially a monkey. You know, he made him a beast, you know, and without God's spirit in us, we are literally nothing, beasts. And so it's really beautiful to be able to go back and just, you know, when you divide out the Bible, to be able to see our lives and others as examples, and be able to use this formula to help judge ourselves now. Because, right, isn't judgment on us now, the whole house of Israel? You know, pride steals our focus from loving our neighbor. You know, it makes us compete. It makes us compare. Thou shalt not covet. I'm better than they are. You know, when we let sinful pride take over, we forget God. That God created us equally, and he treats all of us the same. He's not a respecter of persons. Oh, well, I'm going to treat so-and-so better because he's wealthier, he's smarter, he's good-looking. But this guy over here, you know, he's got his finger in his nose, and what is he doing? Oof. But that's how we, right, self-condemnation, that's how we judge everyone's around us. Because we're the center of our world, and we judge everything based on where we're at and where we fit in the hierarchy. Well, oh, I can't believe that guy and that girl is even thinking about dating that guy. He's ugly. And she's really good looking. I'm much better looking than he is. I'm gonna go get this girl and steal her away from him. Because I'm better than this guy. You know? Is that a good attitude? No. So, you know, with self-centered pride, we start to credit ourselves with our accomplishments, you know, and compare them against others. You know, like the age-old statements, maybe you've heard some of these. I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. I'm more successful than you. You know, and the list could go on. It's that comparison against other people. We need to just compare ourselves against God's word. We need to compare ourselves on where we are in meeting God's expectations for us. Let's not worry about everyone else. Let's not worry about whether they're wealthy or not. Maybe they're wealthy because God blessed them for their obedience. And if anything, they should be an example to follow that, well, you know, I see that God's way works with this person, and I just need to have more faith, and I need to do my job, and I need to be more obedient, and I need to be more sure in what I do, and I need more God's help now than ever. You know, pride is at the heart of bullying and entitlement. You know, there are so many entitled groups out there these days. Everyone has this sense of pride. I'm entitled. Do you know who I am? You know, get down on your knees, right? I need my government cell phone. Yeah, I don't have a job. And I don't want to get a job, you know. You know, it's a deceptive tendency that leaves a wake of destruction in its path. The very nature of human conflict is rooted in elements of pride. And if you want, Proverbs 13:10 says, "Pride only breeds quarrels, but wisdom is found in those who take advice." So, in covering pride today in a different perspective, I hope that maybe we can have a greater appreciation that there is actually a biblical pride that's okay, and then there's a biblical pride that's not. And the difference between them both is sinful pride is centered around self, self-preservation, condemnation of others, and just pure self-centeredness. But godly and biblical pride is outward. It's selfless. It's thinking of others. You know, it's thinking of the beauty of God's creation and taking pride that He loves us. You know, so good pride is an outward pride, not a self-centered pride. So brethren, I hope that this has inspired you to think. And I can't wait to bring the next one up to you, you know, which is going to be the part two, which is fullness of food versus satisfied in eating just enough, grateful of the meal.